boast about your riches, your every wish someone's command. You can go round cheating people by some trickery or plan. You can tell lies on your neighbor and think no one will ever know. But just as sure as you are living, you got to reap just what you sow. You got to reap just what you sow. Yes, you got to reap just what you sow. All the mountain, all the heart in the valley, you got to reap just what you sow. Yes, you can inconvenience others to make things easy for yourself. You can steal some poor man's idea and accumulate great wealth. But here's one thing that will happen. It's been tried and proved before. All the wrong that you are doing, you got to reap just what you sow. You got to reap just what you sow. Yes, you got to reap just what you sow. On the mountain or in a valley, you got to reap just what you sow.
That was jazz and blues singer and songwriter Alberta Hunter, who also was a nurse. She was born on April the 1st, 1895, in Memphis, and her career spanned more than seven decades, beginning as a blues pioneer in the 1920s, as a jazz expatriate in Europe in the 1930s and 40s, and performing on stage and in cabarets. She made a remarkable comeback at the age of 82. I remember going to see her perform at the Cookery nightclub, a kind of eatery and slash nightclub in the West Village. And she wowed audiences every night with her energy and her humor, her great style, but very often with these throwback songs of another era, of the Bessie Smith and Josephine Baker era. She died on October the 17th, 1984, at the age of 89. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead. It is Wednesday, March the 18th, and in a way the song applies and doesn't apply to the two subjects that we're talking about today. One would think that you would reap just what you sow, except that it doesn't necessarily seem to apply to Hillary Rodham Clinton. That's in the second half of our program today. But in the first part of the program, I want to ask the question, are black leaders in Chicago really helping Chuy Garcia? It was an impressive show of support for Jesus Chuy Garcia, the underdog in Chicago's volcanic mayoral runoff slated for April 7th. On March the 9th, an array of African-American ministers, elected officials, community leaders, and business people, the Reverend Jesse Jackson, most prominent among them, pledged their troth to Chuy. Businessman Willie Wilson, who placed third in the February 24th election, the first round, followed with his endorsement 3 days later. Well, happy, happy, joy, joy. But are they really helping this man? Is there a true coalition effort afoot here to put Mr. 1%, as Chicagoans call Rahm Emanuel, out of their misery? Well, it is no surprise that in Chicago, in this election coming up, and this is a real tightrope being walked here, but there's no question as to what the magic formula is. The magic formula is that the constituency that really will make the difference, as it is in many, many major cities, the magic constituency to win over would be the African American community. Rahm Emanuel, when in the first round of elections, when he was stunned, as was Chicago, that he actually had to go to a runoff. He just believed that he had this thing in the bag. But, of course, Chuy Garcia came into the race late and even so managed to pull in a significant enough, more than 34% of the vote, to force this runoff that is scheduled for April the 7th. But in that election, Emanuel carried every single black district. And that, too, was a no-brainer in a way, because he had the blessing of the president, Barack Obama, for whom he was a chief of staff before, of course. Like many people in the Obama administration, these are entrepreneurial politicians, very ambitious people, who will stop at nothing to get where they want to go. He saw early that this was what he wanted as, you know, another rung in the ladder toward the presidency, I imagine. And so he left early. But he did get the support of Chicago's son, Mr. Obama, and that went heavily with the African-American community, so he carried all of the black districts. Chuy Garcia, who is Mexican-American, came into the race late. You may recall that we had talked here about the leader of the Chicago Teachers Union, Karen Lewis, who was being looked at as a pretty promising candidate. And there were talks already in play to not only explore a run, but to explore a more than likely run. Unfortunately, she was diagnosed with a brain tumor, and this came to light just as the race actually was well off and running, so she bowed out. And she endorsed Chuy. She persuaded him to run. He accepted the offer, and he declared his candidacy, but he had a late start. But by then, Rahm Emanuel had pulled in all these millions of dollars because, you know, being a Clintonite, it's what they do. They have access to lots and lots of money. And with that money, they worked the neighborhoods, they worked these constituencies, and he was very well situated to win this race. But the entrance of Chuy Garcia into this race, along with others, made it very, very possible to many people in Chicago that they needed to rethink their choices, and enough people went with Chuy. Now, I must mention here that some of the people, if not all of them, who came out on March the 9th to endorse Chuy Garcia had previously endorsed Rahm Emanuel or chose to remain silent, which is to say, they tacitly endorsed Rahm Emanuel. So how come this turnaround? How come this new way of thinking, and what are we to make of it? Well, for one thing, it's late. It's like days late and dollars short. But look, in politics, you take what you can get when you can get it. And this black, and the endorsement by this black array of people is a very good thing. It's very, very helpful. And it encourages now the African-American community, which is the targeted population for both sides, to rethink their choices and perhaps, you know, move from the Rahm Emanuel camp to the Chuy Garcia camp. My problem is these black leaders. I mean, Chuy Garcia, it seemed to me, was a very, very logical choice from the word go. But they stuck with the Democratic machine because they're all tied to it in one way or the other. They're tied up in it. And
they allowed a late starting campaign to be hampered in gaining momentum because they just went with the other guy. And only when it turned out that the leaders, because the leaders are always behind the followers, it's the people who have the insight and vision. And then, as Mahatma Gandhi would say, you know, there go my people, I'm their leader, so I must catch up with them, you know, that kind of... So the people decided, look, Chuy Garcia is the guy, anybody but Ram, but Chuy Garcia is not a bad guy at all, because, you know, he has a history of community involvement. He was close to Harold Washington, who was just one of the most loved mayors of the city of Chicago. He had credentials as a community guy and a genuine article. But these guys, these leaders, held back. And in my view, that spoke not only to their short-sightedness, but it talks to the degree to which they're wrapped up in the Chicago-style Democratic Party machinery. A lot of people have a lot invested in the city of Chicago, and politics affects that. Rahm Emanuel looks like the bulldozer who will win, whether people hate him or not, that he has all this money that he can, you know, just flex his muscles, and the win now is assured because he learned from the first round that he can't take anything for granted. So after the first round, he ramped up this machine of his, this election machine, to make sure that it is not even left to chance or doubt this time in this runoff with Chuy Garcia, who is going to win. So now, when you announce literally on the cusp of the runoff, the April 7th runoff, you announce for Chuy Garcia on the 9th. And you all announce for Chuy Garcia pretty much on the 9th. He's picked up quite a few very important black endorsements. And that's great. That's fantastic. But I question this. I question the genuineness of the gesture, and why it took so long for them to come to a conclusion about this, as to where the interests of the African-American community are in this contest. People have been saying for years the damage that Rahm Emanuel has been and his administration have been doing to the city's black population and Latino population. Here's a chance to really jam him up by forming a formidable coalition and moving tactically to run him out of town. But they hesitated. They've compromised, essentially. They can't move that fast. And now it also suggests that maybe they're kind of in sync with each other, looking for, you know, the individual deals. What is it that they're likely to get from the Chuy Garcia administration, as opposed to what they know they can get out of the Rahm Emanuel administration? Just today, the Huffington Post published a story about Rahm Emanuel's administration sitting on hundreds of millions of dollars from the housing authority while people are going homeless and can't afford apartments in Chicago. And most of them, of course, are African-American and Latino public housing. So you have this kind of anomaly going on. And a moment in time when these leaders should have been far more insightful and should have come out of the box early for Chuy Garcia. They should have. This is, to me, a horrible development. And it speaks to the entrenched ways of doing things, apart from which, and, you know, on another level, it is all the more disappointing because the guy playing one of the key roles here is Jesse Jackson. And what determined Jesse Jackson's success? And I do say success when he ran in 1984 as an insurgent, of course, he sold out completely by 1988 when he ran again, was the what? Rainbow Coalition. So Jackson knows the value of rainbow coalitions. He knows the value of bringing people together who share a vision for a particular kind of leadership that speaks to the needs of the people. But here he is retarding a moment of growth here for the city of Chicago and the possibility of bringing in a new kind of leadership, a people-centered leadership. He's the leader of this group, pretty much. And this is unfortunate. So, yes, I'm glad that they were able to come to their senses and that they decided publicly to bolster Chuy Garcia's run for mayor. But you can't help but wonder, what the heck are these people thinking? Why are you waiting this long? What was it that prevented you from doing this move, making this move much, much earlier? Giving Rahm Emanuel time and money to ramp up his campaign and ram his candidacy through the city of Chicago once more, a mayor who has been very hostile to the needs of working people and the poor in the city of Chicago. He is a Democrat through and through, and that is not a compliment, by the way. I'm talking about the Chicago-style backroom dealing, bare-knuckled, raw kinds of politics that Chicago is well known for. He's a graduate, a stellar student of that type of politics. It seems to me not only that they were late and days late, as I said, and dollars short, because apart from the endorsements, it's not like these guys are bringing tons of money with them to help Chuy Garcia's campaign, to help get his message out and so forth. It takes money to do that. It's not that their endorsement is translating into all of this. It's not like the pronouncement that we are for Chuy and whatnot is enough. It is not enough. You got to walk with this man. You got to get into the communities. You have to go to bat for him. But it doesn't seem like that's what they're doing. It seems as if they said, well, we endorsed him. That's enough. We have shown good faith, and we've done the right thing. And, you know, that means we are coalition-minded and progressive and all the other trash that people talk with, you know, ceremonial stuff like this. But I don't see evidence that they are deeply committed that this man must win. Rahm Emanuel must go. I don't see that. I see a ceremonial announcement. I see them being very polite to each other. I see them being very supportive, you know, verbally. It's not translating. They're not bringing in a ton of money here. And this is also an issue. Likewise, with the unions, the SEIU, the Service Employment Employees International Union, also came in late on this one. They had gone with Rahm Emanuel in the first round, and, you know, that is typical, and that's so sad, because their membership is largely African-American and Latino. And one would have thought that a forward-thinking union from the word go would have known what to do to signal a decision that we can't support a hostile mayor and a hostile administration. Well, they finally turned the corner and came out at the same time that these elected officials pledged their troth to Chuy Garcia, and they have now decided to stand with him. And they are putting money into his campaign. But here's the problem. Momentum, loss of momentum, that is huge in a political issue, especially one as tight as this, a runoff, where you have an incumbent, nasty as he was, hostile as he was, is, sorry, wrong tense, nonetheless having the advantage of name recognition, having the advantage of fundraising, making stuffing his political coffers, having the advantage of a very, you know, polite press, actually. They're not nearly as critical of him as they ought to be. So he has a great advantage coming into the race as an incumbent. Chuy García is a 100% uphill climb. He has never run for office before at this level. He's new to this whole game at this level. I mean, he's been able to observe it in his relationship with Harold Washington. But for all intents and purposes, he's a new guy. And all the more reason that we should see a different approach from the African-American leadership here, not only on the part of getting away from this predictability that it is so tied to the Democratic old Chicago machine that it can't cut its navel string, but beyond that, that it actually is a progressive movement, that they understand that Chicago's African-American and Latino communities, the most oppressed of the ethnic communities in the city, deserve something different. And therefore, when that something different presents itself, your job is to jump into the fray and help that candidate succeed. So all of this to say that I think that, you know, it's wonderful that they came forward finally and saw the logic of it. I don't know the genuineness of their intention. It may just be, you know, one of those symbolic things. I'm hoping that that's not the case. But I am contending that their slowness to respond appropriately in this process, where the stakes are so high for their own constituencies in Chicago, you know, these guys have something to answer for, just the same. This is not good leadership. This is not insightful leadership. And I question how and why they chose to enter the fray this late. As if to say, well, he was, you know, Chuy García himself was late to the process. No, but they had a choice. From February the 24th, they had a choice. And to wait this long, literally on the cusp of this very, very important election, to do these kinds of things in kind of, you know, ceremonial, lackluster way, it just ain't flying. It just is not flying with me at all. So yet another instance in which we hopefully are not seeing poor leadership here. Hopefully they will get into this thing more vigorously and push Chuy García, not just because it's Chuy García, but because it is a moment in time, just like it was a moment in time for Jesse Jackson, for Willie Wilson, the businessman in Chicago, as it was for any other candidate who had a different vision that was people-centered. They really do need to step up. Secondly, there is this history of the great chill between African-Americans and Latinos, and it exists in those cities where you have sizable portions of proportions of the population that are Latino and African American. We haven't seen good coalition building at all. This was a chance and is a chance for them to, you know, just erase that record a bit, take the hard edge off, and begin to put in place a new kind of template for politics, the politics of the future, the near future. I'll take this break and come back and talk with about Sister Hillary right after this.
Of a fellow man that's down, you can take somebody's heartstring, ooh, and drag it on the ground. I have other people just because you're having luck. even double-cross your best friend, and then try to pass the buck. But there's one thing that will happen, makes no difference where you go. Just before your final curtain, you got to reap just what you sow. You got to reap just what you sow. Yes, you got to reap just what you sow. On the mountain and the valley, you got to reap just what you sow.
You gotta reap just what you sow, says Alberta Hunter. I really enjoyed her. You know, it's a very interesting story, by the way. I mentioned earlier that she was a nurse, and her story was that she lied to get her job by misrepresenting her age. She was substantially older than they thought. She had taken this hiatus from singing and performing, and went to nursing school at the age of 59. And of course, when she graduated, she wanted to be part of the job market. And so she lied about her age. And when she had her comeback at 82, and this was as a result of prodding from very close friends, insisting that she should get back to entertaining, and she informed her job that she was quitting. They thought she was retiring. She had to tell them, I should have retired. I qualified for retirement at least 20 years ago. Alberta Hunter, wonderful lady, great entertainer. I enjoyed her very, very much. Well, that she finds herself in the eye of yet another firestorm, calling her character, well, what's left of it, ethics, what's left of those, and official conduct into question, should be no surprise. Hillary Clinton, after all, is one half of the most often subpoenaed and criminally investigated couples to ever occupy the White House. With a reported 6 separate investigations currently in play over a private email account and server that she used when she was Secretary of State, Clinton finds herself in familiar territory as a target of official inquiry and even possibly prosecution. Her response, though, is also familiar. Her attitude is, I dare you to prove anything you think I did. Today, a poll says, by CNN, says that with all the controversy swirling around this woman, she nonetheless is at the top of the list as a presidential or would-be presidential candidate in 2016. Now, how does this happen? What is the secret to the ability of Mrs. Clinton, who has a very long list of charges and transgressions over her political life that have dogged her all these years? How is it that this woman still stands as a kind of squeaky, clean, innocent beacon of woman power? How's that happen? I have a couple of theories, and I'm happy to share them with you. But this is an interesting thing, that we are all, in a way, living in Hillary Clinton's surreal universe. And in her surreal universe, people like her prevail. And they prevail because, like, again, we just talked about Rahm Emanuel, they are of the same kind of political animal. You know, they learn a type of politics that is just so fundamentally obscene. And their ambitions know no bounds. And so
people would be, it would be hard for people to understand how these folks function. What is it that they think about? And my suspicion is that power for power's sake. They just like the idea of controlling things, controlling people, controlling the world, controlling the country, controlling everything. That's them. And money. Lots and lots and lots and lots of money. But Hillary Clinton, you have to, you can't dismiss the attitude. The attitude is, and I'm sure psychologists will be making something of this, people who study how the mind works, that here's a woman yet again in the crosshairs, yet again in the crosshairs of wrongdoing, alleged wrongdoing, but it ain't looking all that good for her. And yet, the vast majority of Americans regard her as the top candidate for president. And beyond that, believe that she deserves to be president, as of course Hillary does. As Hillary thinks, so do we. The time has come for her to be president. Let's take a look at Ms. Clinton in a way. In just recent years, we're not going to go all the way back, just recent years, Mrs. Clinton, having left the White House, when she left the White House, in fact, she left the White House before Bill did. You remember Bill at the time was saddled with peccadilloes. He was dealing with some peccadilloes, and it obviously caused a strain, one would imagine. And Hillary actually left the White House 2 years before he did. They had apparently worked out a plan because, you know, they're both very seedy people. And they appreciate raw ambition in each other because that's what kind of holds them together. And they probably said, well, look, you know, she says, well, I need to do my own thing now. I have been silent, and I've supported you, and I've done the Good Wife Act. I pulled it off, and now it's Hillary time. And Hillary, because people like this tend to talk in the third person, Hillary wants to be a U.S. senator. Ultimately, Hillary wants to rule the world, but we will start with the U.S. Senate. And so the word came down from on high because Bill Clinton was the de facto leader of the Democratic Party. And he sent out the word that, yep, that's what we're going to give her. We're going to give Hillary what she wants because whatever Hillary wants, Hillary gets. And the U.S. Senate was what she wanted. And they made it happen. She walked out of the White House and walked into the U.S. Senate. Not a bad place to start a political career. Now, most people running for office, especially at that level, you would tend to see a gradual, you know, climb. You know, you run for cat catcher, then you run for dog catcher, and so forth, and then you move up the ranks. That's the dues most people pay, not Hillary. They cleared the way, and a whole bunch of everybody fell in line. Everybody fell in line. They had to make her the U.S. Senator from the state of New York, where she never lived before. But the 2 years that she took off early from the White House, in part was to establish, you know, a residence in New York State, you know, to satisfy the qualifications for running to represent a state and you didn't ever lived in. And she wrapped that up in 2 years. And so it was presented by a compliant press. I love the word that Paul Craig Roberts has coined called the prestitutes. They complied. They brought her victory. They were just so in love with Hillary. Hillary, Hillary, Hillary. And the Democratic Party faithful paved the way. They cleared everybody out. Nobody was allowed really to mount a serious campaign as a Democrat against her. They quashed that. She was given literally the path to the U.S. Senate as a gift for being the compliant wife. Now, here's a woman who talks about women's rights and all of this kind of stuff. She had no problem playing the good wife to get that role. So she is now a U.S. senator. And the same thing happens. She runs, finally, she makes a run along with Barack Obama and others for the presidency, and then was stunned that the magic didn't quite work, because overwhelmingly people went for Barack Obama. How could this have happened? She was rejected. The people were so stupid. They were so blind. They were just so immature to have chosen Obama. But then another round of negotiations, and I'm using that in quotes because it sounded, I think it was more like an ultimatum. You will give me Secretary of State. I don't want to be vice president, as a lot of people thought, because a vice president's job is to blend with the woodwork. You're not supposed to be seen and heard too much. You're just supposed to be there. But that's not her style. She wants to be president. And the closest she came to president was, hey, Secretary of State. I literally am president without being president. I'm running all over the world. I'm flying for free in the best jets with the best pilots, best service crew. I'm staying in the best hotels. Not a penny is coming out of my pocket. And of course, at the time, she was also, if you really are naive and think that it was all about everything, 100% of these trips all over the world was about U.S. government business, then I have a bridge to sell you. So, and all of this really, in a way, in a very classic passive-aggressive way, upstaging the actual president to become more popular than he was, more visible than he was, and literally calling the shots at the State Department. Well, let's hear a little something about the State Department. And this is coming from a wonderful source. I recommend it to you that you take a look at this. And he's talking here about Hillary Clinton's time at the State Department and what emerged as a cause of concern. But I mean, no big deal, right? No big deal. When she was the U.S. Secretary of State, it turns out that there was a missing $6 billion. How did that come to be? Well, listen to this.
Without a doubt, government is one of the most corrupt institutions on the face of the planet. Washington, D.C., one of the most corrupt spheres of that corruption. And there's many types of corruption, but one of the most notable is the no-bid contracts, the fraudulent, non-accountable contracts, the money that goes missing from government agencies. And they all do it. They've all been guilty of it, not just of throwing big parties and like extravagant expenses, but also classic cases like when the Department of Defense admitted they couldn't track more than $2.3 trillion with a T dollars. Coincidentally, the day before 9/11 on September 10th, 2001, when Rumsfeld made the announcement that their database was not able to track where $2.3 trillion in transactions was going, who had the bids, whether or not they had been fulfilled, whether or not, you know, it was done under the ethical treatments. And we've heard about things like Cheney, who had been at Halliburton inside the Bush administration, Halliburton reportedly making more than $40 billion in the Iraq War, while Cheney personally supposedly made $34 million off of those contracts, things like that. We've heard about the Pentagon's gold toilet seats going back to the early 90s and some of the ethics investigations that came out of the late 80s, those kinds of things, $400 hammers and bolts and different parts, which are not even the worst forms of corruption, but clearly they're corrupt, overpaying for contracts that end up being in the hands of friends of politicians and those in the powerful positions. And just the fact that the Project on Government Oversight has a federal contractor misconduct database is very telling in its own right. And Lockheed Martin is at the top of the list. Boeing, General Dynamics, Northrop Grumman. It's very military industrial complex oriented, and a lot of other firms involved in that as well. IT firms and security, you know, KBR's on there, of course. You know, you can go check out that list for yourself. But this story caught my eye because it's $6 billion that went missing at the State Department. And they do bring up in the story how it creates a lack of oversight that exposes the department to significant financial risk, because they admitted they had billions upon billions of unaccountable dollars over the last 6 years throughout the entire Obama administration. And they talk about in the story how these conditions are conducive to fraud. Certainly they are, because corrupt individuals know that if there's not going to be proper oversight, they can go to their friends. They can encourage them to do fraudulent contracts. If politicians are already corrupt, they're not going to mind overbilling the taxpayers so their friends can get rich. Maybe they get kickbacks. Maybe they just have good business relations down the road. But what I found particularly insightful, particularly outrageous about $6 billion missing at the State Department during the Obama administration, five of those years of which Hillary Clinton was Secretary of State overseeing that department, was that the State Department was without an inspector general position for more than 5 years, the longest inspector general vacancy in all of the government's history, according to the Washington Post. That is outrageous. The inspector generals, of course, are supposed to oversee the departments that investigate potential fraud, do the accounting, make sure things are going where they're supposed to, you know, all in the name of good government and transparency on the benefit of the taxpayers. Of course, most of these inspector generals are castrated to begin with. There's probably a lot of corruption there as well. But to not even have an inspector general position, oh, you know that's open to some corruption. And again, not only under the Obama administration, but under Hillary Clinton, who you can love her, you can hate her, that's up to you. But the lady has been accused of all kinds, all manner of corrupt behavior. There's all the stuff her husband was involved in, and then there's all the stuff she was allegedly involved in. There's an entry for the Hillary Rodham cattle futures controversy dating back to the late 70s when she was allegedly involved in fraud with cattle future contracts. I'm not saying if that's true or not, but there's the accusation. There's the Whitewater controversy about the corrupt land deals her and her husband Bill were involved in, and the other people, the McDougal family. Not saying if it's true or not, but it's an existing controversy. There's all the accusations about Hillary Clinton's role as Secretary of State with Benghazi. That's not necessarily as financially related, but another controversy she's involved in. Hillary Clinton, if you go back, was fired from the Watergate Committee for committing fraud and ethics violations, the committee that was supposed to be investigating not the Whitewater controversy we already talked about, but the Watergate controversy with Nixon. She was fired after being accused of fraud and ethics violations. Not saying if it's true or false, but the allegations are out there, and she was removed from that position. Then you've got, from 2008, all kinds of allegations about corrupt campaign financing allegations. Lots of names involved in that. I don't know if it's true, but they're out there. There's a whole bunch of stories about it. That's Examiner. Here's a Washington Post. Well, as soon as this tab opens, there's also a Washington Post entry on DC executive linked to secret 2008 aid to Hillary Clinton. And that's just a handful of the scandals the woman's been involved in. And then you've got the $6 billion missing while she was the most powerful position in the State Department, while there's no inspector general at all, no pretense of accountability or oversight, and they can't figure out where these dollars went, who got the contracts, can't figure out if the contracts were fulfilled properly, if there was any shady deals going on, if all the terms were met. Were there friends of any of these people, including Hillary Clinton, involved in this? I don't know. That's not for me to say. Let's ask the inspector general. Problem is, Stephen Linsk has only been on the job 6 months, and now he's come up with the $6 billion number. It could take him years longer to even sort of kind of get to the bottom of all this. While no one was even pretending to guard the hen house for more than 5 years during the entire Obama administration. Think about all the foreign policy scandals, all the potential front groups in countries around the entire world, all the rumors about CIA front groups that are involved with State Department actions, all the stuff about color revolutions and youth groups doing things in places like Egypt, where the corrupt money changing hands there. How many years will it take us to even have those questions properly raised? I don't know, but it sure looks incriminating. I mean, what blatant corruption. How could this be allowed to happen in a so-called democratic republic, a place with a constitution? That is definitely corrupt, and Washington's already a very corrupt place. It's probably a whole lot more money than that, but that's the number they come up with so far. All right, that's it. True Stream Media.
The Clintons have a rather sordid history, but you would never know that because nobody really questions this. And in the middle of all of this euphoria about Hillary and Hillary and Hillary and this new poll that shows she is the leading candidate for president of the United States, you find no criticisms at all about, I mean, the past just disappears. The media make this woman's past, political past, and all of these questions that still linger and hover in her background, they make them disappear. I would recommend to you that you go to a website. Sam Smith, who was on this program some time ago, talking about Hillary Clinton. Sam Smith is a veteran journalist. He had covered, about 9 different presidents in his career. He puts out something called the Progressive Review, and it's online, prorev.com. ProRev.com, and he has covered Hillary Clinton more than anybody else I know. And there is a segment when you go to ProRev, you get to see a section that he calls Some of Hillary Clinton's Greatest Hits. And here he documents in great detail a long list of major, major ethical issues that have dogged her that she just miraculously has walked away from. How does this happen? How do we get Hillary Clinton, first of all, in office? She was not qualified at all to be Secretary of State. She got the gift of a U.S. Senate seat, and it is corruption. That was a totally corrupt process. You know, she, quote, ran for office, unquote, and, you know, there was a campaign and whatnot, but we know how that happened. The Democratic Party went into its typical Chicago style, which is where she's from, too, in terms of politics, not just Arkansas, but it's Chicago-style politics, and they cleared the way. These same people, including some of the same folks from Harlem, like Charlie Rangel and others, when Shirley Chisholm ran for president or wanted to run for president, they did everything possible to impede her campaign. But Hillary, they just let everything, they gave everything to this campaign, alleged campaign. It looked like a campaign, but we know that the work was done in the back rooms. That was a deal. The campaign was anticlimactic, really. The campaign was the aftermath of the deal that was made. And then you become Secretary of State based on what qualifications? I mean, all of the folks who have been Secretary of State, except for Hillary Clinton, had walked through that door with serious credentials, major credentials. Hillary Clinton doesn't really even speak a second language, but she was Secretary of State and ran the department, as we know from official reports, poorly. We will be talking about Hillary Clinton's greatest hits, and we will be asking constantly and consistently why it is that Hillary Clinton continues to elude, especially from the liberal media, scrutiny, and nobody, everybody pretends that this past just does not exist. And they still hold to the idea that she is the exemplar of woman power in today's United States. Well, I'm not of that club. I think it is, in fact, an insult, and I think it is, in fact, a tragic, especially for women, the women's movement, such as it is, that people are very tight-lipped about Hillary Clinton, and worse, that they are actually touting her without calling into question her very, very spotted past. And this is not small stuff. These issues are not small things at all. These are major stuff. But they're not raising it. They're giving her a free pass. They have already done so. And it looks like they will continue to do that, to give her a pass. When we pick up this conversation again, we will be discussing what it is in America that allows a Hillary Clinton to basically get that pass. What is it, you think? I'm sure we will have some ideas on that. I want to thank you so much for joining me today. I hope that the program brought some ideas to your mind. We are continuing to rebuild the studios and instituting the guts of the operation, which are the phone lines and so forth. So very shortly, we hope to have those in fine working order so we can resume with gusto our two-way conversation with each other. And I look forward to that. They're working very, very hard to accomplish this. This was a major, major move and a complicated move and a fast move, moving against the clock. So they've done a marvelous job so far of bringing us along. And we have continued our broadcast despite the enormous obstacles that were put in the path of PRN. So I want to thank you for your patience. It will be rewarded very soon when we will be up and running with each other again, as we usually do. Stay tuned. Coming up next is Economic Update with Jack Rasmus. And you can reach me at leadstories@gmail.com and on Facebook, Lead Stories with Utrice Lead. As always, a pleasure and a great, great privilege to be in your company. I want to end, though, with letting you know that as PRN upgrades, so must Lead Stories. So we will be doing a little fundraising of our own to get ourselves in gear so that we are compatible technologically with the studio, and we can have a very smooth transmission, of information. So we'll be talking about that. But mostly, I look forward to a grand reunion when I get the signal that our phone lines are perfect, they're testing them, and that everything is all right. Until then, see you tomorrow. Bye-bye.
What you sow, yes, you can take every advantage of a fellow man that's down. You can take somebody's heartstring, ooh, and drag it on the ground. I have other people. Just because you're having luck, even double cross your best friend and then try to pass the buck. But there's one thing that will happen, makes no difference where you go. Just before your final curtain, you got to reap just what you sow. You got to reap just what you sow. Yes, you got to reap just what you sow. On the mountain and the valley.